The top of the Corona bottle twisted off with a satisfying snap. A dash of salt and a lime wedge slid easily down the bottleneck, and he took a deep swig. The cold beer always settled his nerves. Clicking on the link to his email, Doc saw 23 more entry hopefuls for his books. Jeez, what the fuck have I gotten myself into? He looked across the names of the stories and found one called Night of the Living Farts, and promptly deleted it. It was too silly. He opened the file entitled Deadpan Humor, and read it carefully. The short story, a flash actually, only 350 words, was about a zombie clown. Replying quickly, he emailed an acceptance to the author and took another drink, feeling the beer slide down his throat and then go straight to his head. He leaned back for a moment and put his hands behind his head and stretched deep. It had been a long day. 2 root canals and a crown. Some guy had come in wanting a grill made of gold and diamonds. He wondered how much longer he could actually overcharge these people before they got wise to his games. Doc began to doze, his eyelids becoming heavy. Then a knock at the door roused him from his daydream. Doc stood and walked up the stairs from his studio to the door. He opened it to find Rob Best standing there. Rob's face was badly scarred and hastily stitched together. Rob stared at Doc for a moment before stepping aside. DWM was behind him. He raised a harpoon gun and took aim. Doc began to run, turning briefly to take stock of the situation when the harpoon slammed into his shoulder, pinning him to the wall. DWM laughed lightly, reloaded, and pinned his other shoulder, forcing Doc to stare straight at him. DWM, why, brother? As he spoke, he saw a clear surgical scar across his forehead and an empty look in his eyes. April stepped through the doorway behind DWM, brandishing a butcher knife. She approached Doc, the same scar and look in her eyes that DWM had. She knelt before him, grabbing his legs. He struggled, but April, against her size, was too strong.
No, 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 April, no.
She deftly slid the knife across his Achilles tendons, severing any chance he had of escape. Thank God, damn it, the girls weren't here to see this, Doc thought to himself. Robert reemerged from the doorway, carrying what looked like a typewriter case. He set it down and looked at Doc.
Doc, Doc, Doc. I'm a survivor, Doc. So many attempts on my life. Look what happened to those two,
Rob said, pointing at April and DWM.
Amazing how suggestible one can be after a simple lobotomy. Now, you always did say that the podcast was for the librarians. Now, how about it be by the librarians? I'm taking your show and your publishing company.
Rob walked calmly to the open case and pulled out a typewriter. He hefted its weight in both hands, turned and put momentum behind the swing. The last thing Doc would ever see was the word Typee written across the typewriter. An ironic name to an ironic end that was the last thought Doc had before Rob crushed his skull. 1 week later. Rhiannon Frater sat at her computer. The newest episode of Library of the Living Dead was downloaded, her headphones on, and it was time to write.
Brains. 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 You're listening to the Library of the Living Dead.
Hello, good librarians.
The podcast started. Though Doc's voice wasn't the one behind the opening. It was Robert Best.
This week's episode is going to be a little different. You could say Doc's mind is all over other things. But no worries. We good librarians have stepped in and will continue on in his absence. Today we have Darkwing Manus and Zombie Farmer with me as guest hosts. Say hi, guys.
Hello.
I saw a dog poop out a peanut once.
And back to the show!
Library of the Living Dead is where you should be. Dr. Huppus is your host, most talented you'll soon see. And you'll find in his mind zombies of all kinds, in his head, in his head, there are zombies. With the books and movies and stories, in his head, in his head, there are zombies.
And welcome, good librarians, to episode number 83 of Library of the Living Dead. I really am back. That was just a story you listened to first by DWM. I thought it came out really great. Then you had Zombie by Steve Kane. Then we got a song called Dark Side by Nituris. Then we get Zombie Survivors, My Hate of the Dead, Part 2. You're going to like this one. You're going to recognize one of the characters. And then we get Eric S. Brown's Unabridged, Unabashed, and Undead, called No Goodbyes. Then, due to our music librarian, he found us a story by David Sloan called Is There Anybody Out There? We get Chapter 3 of A.P. Fuchs' Blood of the Dead, entitled Off to the Promised Land. And then we get some out comments by your good old Dr. Puss, and then a wonderful rendition of Fever by Laura Best. So what are you waiting for? Turn up those headphones on that iPod. Turn up those speakers on your computer. Do what you want, because we're presenting episode number 83 of Library of the Living Dead. Hey, ho, let's go!
just here, I'm not wasting a moment. Oh, just here, I'm not wasting a moment. Well, something's telling me where I should go. Well, there's an apple upon my shoulder, and I'm one trying to wiggle out. A trespasser faces me not. Well, I'm a seeker of truth. A non-existing reality sees me live my life passionately. Well, there's a dark side to everyone. Even when the moon is new, a waiting moment seems to pass. The only thing left is what the thing I'll do. Oh, it's crystal. Sensations, no limitations. There's a dark side to everyone. Even when the moon is new, a waiting moment seems to pass. The only thing left is what I think of you.
This long-ass story is by Zombie Survivor and called The Doctor Will See You Now, My Hate for the Dead, Part 2. Dale took another sip of his illegally imported beer as he changed channels of his television that only seemed to run on his profanities. Things certainly have changed, he mumbled to himself in the fluorescent glow of the screen.
Maggots in your ear? Use maggot spray and the critters will go away.
A zombie in an expensive suit said in what was obviously a low-budget infomercial. The zombie slowly walked to the audience and smiled. His crooked yellow teeth and black gums made Dale sick.
Seems like you have maggots yourself,
the suit said to an elderly zombie whose head was completely bald and one eye socket was wiggling with worms.
I sure do, the woman groaned.
It sounded like sandpaper scraping on a piece of wood. The suit took her hand and led her to a chair where a young female zombie was already prepping the useless crap they were trying to sell. Dale looked at the girl. She didn't seem dead, only her skin was pale. But then she turned and a hole appeared in the back of her head. Fake hair was draped over it to cover it up, but Dale could see it right away. Damn, a suicide, he said and snapped his fingers. He lost interest again and grabbed the remote. As he changed the channels, he only heard dead voices. Living voices were becoming more and more unusual these days. He fondly remembered the days when zombies on the television were forbidden. The days when zombies that walked on the street without a living escort were killed on sight. He sighed and miraculously found the channel with living humans. A smile appeared on his face, and he grabbed another beer from the mini-fridge next to the sofa. He leaned back, took a sip, and watched a news anchor tell a story about economics. Normally, this sort of thing would bore him to death, pun not intended. But he was so euphoric with hearing a normal voice again that he just focused on the sound instead of the story. He closed his eyes and felt peaceful, something he hadn't felt in over 20 years. A comfortable deep sleep slowly embraced him. A gurgle almost made him jump from the sofa. He looked at the television and gagged at the sight before him. An erotic zombie advertisement. Fucking hell. His eyes followed the crooked curves of the skeleton-like bodies, writhing and slithering through their leather straps and other clothing that was supposed to be sensual. They were dancing around poles, winking their white eyes and licking their black fingertips. He closed his eyes and instinctively pressed on the power button on the television. That was the last thing he would ever do to fight his loneliness. He looked at his digital watch he'd bought for $1 at the corner of the street from some embalming fluid addict. He felt disgusted that he'd bought something from a zombie, but he had no choice, given the financial situation he was in. The green number softly glowed in the dark.
Time to sleep, he said with a yawn,
and he stretched as he walked to the bedroom. He tried not to look at his reflection. Glimpses of a broken man with a bushy beard told him more than enough about his miserable life. He grabbed his toothbrush and toothpaste from the sink. He turned the faucet on, and after a few seconds, water poured out of it. It slowly filled the sink. It still wasn't as clean as it used to be, but it was a hell of an improvement in comparison of the time when the dead first rose. He made his toothbrush wet and looked at the toothpaste slowly coming out of the tube as he pressed on it. It made him think of a skull that was being penetrated by a bullet, with all the soft tissue seeping out of it. He started brushing. Not that he cared about dental hygiene. It was just a routine, one of the last things that was normal in life. When he reached one of the molars of his lower jaw, he began to feel a burning sensation. The sensation intensified as the paste drowned the tooth. He yanked the brush out of his mouth and spit the toothpaste into the sink. Blood. No, 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 he whispered as he opened his mouth and looked in the mirror. It was too dark to see anything. He could taste the iron of the blood and the bitterness of pus. He ran to the kitchen and rifled through the crappy drawers that were only held together with a single nail.
Fuck,
he cursed. And another wave of pain engulfed his mouth. He held his hand against his cheek. Fucking shit, he said, as the bloody drool ran out of his mouth. He avoided swallowing as much as possible, but it made him feel like an idiot, running in his house, drooling like a dog. His fingers felt the rubbery surface of the flashlight. With a triumphant smile, he returned to the bathroom, and with a click, a faint light shone in his mouth, exposing everything. What Dave saw wasn't pleasant. The gum around the tooth was flaming red, and the tooth itself was discolored. He threw the flashlight on the floor, making it shatter into tiny pieces. He slammed his fist on the sink. He had to make an appointment with Dr. West soon. The waiting room was claustrophobic, nauseating, and every nasty word Dave could think of. He shifted his weight in the weak plastic chair he was sitting in and looked around with disgust. Next to him was a living man. Thankfully, his eyes shifted nervously and sweat stained his shirt. He had loosened his tie and was nervously tapping his fingers on his lap. Dave wondered if he thought the same thing. If those maggot bags attack me, I can't possibly escape. He looked at the exit. How long would it take him to reach it if he got out fast as he could? A dead woman coughed, and a wet gurgle followed. Her cracked lips were covered with rancid purple lipstick. Couldn't hide her weak teeth that wiggled as she moved her jaws from right to left. Suddenly, their eyes locked. Dave's bright green eyes and her cold gray eyes, devoid of any recognizable emotion. He quickly stared at his feet. He should probably get new shoes. He had these shoes since he got fired from that job at the factory. He was replaced by, what else, a zombie that could do his job faster and longer. Loud buzzing made Dave look at a bug zapper in the corner, near the receptionist. That's when he noticed the flies circling above the rotting heads. "Disgusting," he mouthed and closed his eyes. "Mr. Hewitt," the receptionist said to everyone waiting. The guy next to Dale stood up, grabbed his handkerchief, and wiped his forehead. He straightened his tie and walked to the door, passing the guy that left the room. Dale could see the doctor making preparations for his next patient. He shook hands with Mr. Hewitt and closed the door behind him. Now, he was the only living thing, with the exception for the receptionist and the good doctor himself, of course. It astounded him that Dr. West would treat zombies. During his last visit, he told him that he wanted to get rid of them as soon as possible. But from a dentistry standpoint, zombies suffer from bad oral hygiene practices, so that meant more patients and thus more money. He shook his head. The people can lose their standards and dignity just to make money. He could have been working now at another factory, a couple of miles from here, but he refused when he saw his colleagues and boss. He just couldn't work with the stinking bastards. That's when he suddenly remembered his neighbor, Mr. Maynard. Whatever happened to him? That's right. He had a double death sentence for killing his elderly zombie neighbors. He remembered reading about it in the papers and on television. He was just doing his duty as a living person. We should protect ourselves from the undead threat. While Dale shared the same ideology as his neighbor, he was too much of a coward to actually kill zombies. The world went even more crazy after Maynard's double death. People were sympathizing with the zombies and how they must struggle in a world that wants them back in the ground. So, new laws were established for the good of the undead citizens. One of the measures they took was to terminate the dead districts, making it possible for zombies to live wherever they wanted. One of the worst moves the government did since the illegalization of shooting the undead and equal rights. Now they seeped into every aspect of the lives of the living. Schools were no longer separated. No separate butchers, libraries, and other public locations. It made avoiding them nearly impossible. He stared at the light in the ceiling. He could hear the door squeaking as another zombie stumbled in. It was a woman with only one arm and one eye, her eye scanning the room. Dale froze. How in the world did she get here? The woman's eye locked on Dale's shivering appearance.
"You son of a bitch," she said as she grabbed his arm. "Why did you leave me there? Look at me. Look at me."
She opened her mouth and tried to bite him.
"I'll drag you with me into purgatory."
Dale screamed and kicked in her stomach. His boots sank in the soft tissue, and he saw black stains appearing on her dress.
"Bastard,"
she yelled.
"That was my new dress."
Dale struggled to get loose. "Leave me alone. You're not my wife anymore." And he pushed her to the floor. She fell on the small table, spilling all the old magazines on the floor. Loud cracks and an unusual posture of her body told Dale that he'd broken her back. Everyone was quiet, their eyes strained on the man that attacked one of them. Tears rolled down Dale's cheek.
"I loved you, but I can't live with you anymore, Patricia."
Patricia struggled to get up, but she slipped on the smooth surface of the table. With a smack, she fell on her mouth. Long, sticky strands of black blood and fragments of teeth ran from her mouth. The two old lovers just stared at each other. The door opened again, and a living police officer entered the waiting room.
"What's going on?"
he asked, and he looked at the struggling Patricia. A young zombie stood up.
"He attacked her. He went crazy when he saw her."
The other zombies nodded and mumbled that it was true. Dale shook his head.
No, she attacked me first. She wanted to bite me. Patricia finally stood back on her feet.
Ma'am,
the officer asked,
is that true?
She stared at the floor.
He left me. He left me behind during the beginning. He needs to be with me. Forever.
The officer sighed.
I think you need to come with me, ma'am,
he said, and he escorted her to his car. Patricia stared at Dale again, with sadness, and left his sight. Dale felt the tension in the air, but he wasn't planning to give in much longer. Thank you for covering each other's asses, he said in a sarcastic tone, and he sat back down. Some of the zombies grabbed a magazine from the floor and pretended to read. The receptionist went back to her normal routine.
Meat,
one of the undead patients said. Dale let it slip. He didn't feel like fighting, despite being furious. He came here to see the dentist, and that's what he was going to do. The police car slowly drove away with flashing lights, mixing in the traffic with ease. With all the commotion still playing in his head, Dale didn't hear the receptionist calling his name.
Mr. Hampton,
the receptionist now said with an elevated voice. Dale jumped up and walked to the door. He passed Mr. Hewitt, who seemed more pale and sluggish than he saw him last time. He rasped and moaned softly as he walked to the hall stand to grab his coat. Must be the anesthetic, Dale thought, and entered the room where the doctor inspected his instruments.
Ah, Mr. Hampton, he said and smiled from behind his face mask.
Hello, Doc. One of my molars is hurting like hell. Dr. West grabbed his gloves and instruments.
Let's see what I can do. Open your mouth as wide as you can.
Dale could only see a shadow hovering over him.
Can you dim the light a little?
Dr. West laughed.
I'm sorry, but I need to see everything properly.
Dale slightly nodded. Music was softly playing in the background as the doctor used his rather sharp instruments to investigate the rotten tooth. After a few moments of silence, the doctor cleared his throat.
Yeah, that needs to come out. It's really rotten. Looks a bit like an undead tooth.
Dale laughed with him, out of politeness, but he didn't see the humor in it. It really hurt like hell. With teary eyes, he tried to think of something pleasant. The shadow disappeared, only to reappear again with a syringe.
I'm going to sedate the area around the tooth, and this may hurt a bit.
The doctor didn't lie. Dale groaned softly as the sharp needle penetrated his inflamed gums.
It's been a while since I've sedated one of my patients. Most of them don't even feel pain. Now, we wait for a moment.
Dale felt the anesthetic working. The numbness was a relief from the constant pain he felt since last night.
You know, West said as he grabbed the right instruments, I heard you fighting back in there.
Dale was silent.
Losing a loved one is tough, though.
West poked in the gum he'd sedated earlier.
Is that hurt?
He asked, and he looked in the drowsy eyes of Dale. Dale, in return, shook his head.
What's feeling?
He asked with a long slur. West laughed.
Just a normal reaction when you're infected with the zombie virus.
Dale's eyes sprang open.
A mummy virus?
West turned off the light and removed his face mask.
Yeah, the zombie virus.
He looked back at Dale, who was now shaking. West's face was horribly disfigured. He had large holes in his cheeks, the exposed yellow teeth and purple tongue that wiggled between his jaws made a strange clicking noise as West laughed. Dale tried to get up, but West pushed him down.
You're not done yet,
and he stuck his hand in his mouth. He pulled the rotten tooth out of his mouth with some strength. Dale could hear loud cracking and felt his jaws break. Dale yelled at the top of his lungs, but was smothered with West's hands.
Shh, we don't want to scare the other patients now, do we?
And grabbed Dale's tongue with his rubbery fingers. Dale punched West with his fists, but that did little to his determination to shut him up forever. With a quick yank, Dale's tongue was ripped out of his mouth. Blood squirted like a fountain,
and Dale coughed as he tried to prevent himself from choking. Wes looked curiously at the piece of flesh clenched in his fist.
Wow, that was an easy one,
and threw the tongue into a small garbage can. He laughed at all the blood splattered everywhere.
Life's funny, as he disposed of his blood-drenched gloves. One day you're in the sun, and then you're suddenly attacked by zombie-freaking cows.
Dale turned on his side and puked. He had no strength left to resist. His vision blurred, and everything went in slow motion. West pressed on the intercom.
Miss Watts, he said while keeping an eye on Dale, we have quite a mess over here. Can you send someone to clean it up?
The intercom static was interrupted with the voice of the receptionist.
Sure, Dr. West. As a matter of fact, he just cleaned up Mr. Hewitt's mess he made in the waiting room.
West circled around Dale, who tried to speak. Instead of words, only desperate sounds came out of his throat. The door opened, and Dale concentrated on the large man that entered the room. The skin on his head was wrapped tight over his skull. His wide eyes were sunken, and his cheekbones almost punctured the mummified skin. He grabbed Dale by his collar and lifted him. The man looked in Dale's eyes with excitement. He smiled, showing shining teeth.
My latest invention, metal teeth for zombies.
The man chomped his razor-sharp teeth in Dale's throat and ripped out a large piece of flesh and several arteries. A gushing fountain of blood sprayed over the mummified man, who didn't seem to be bothered by it. Dale was dropped on the floor in the puddle of blood that had formed beneath him. With the last of his strength, he looked at West's maniacal smile. That's when Dale noticed the new name tag on his coat. Dr. Puss.
Welcome, good librarian, to another edition of Eric S. Brown's Unabridged, Unabashed, and Undead. This story is called No Goodbyes. The creature stood in the doorway, its skin a pale gray. Maggots wormed their way through its flesh, and its lower lip dangled from its mouth, attached only by the thinnest thread of tendon. Once, it had been human, but no longer. It wore the tattered remains of a military uniform. A low moan escaped its lips as it stumbled towards Tony. He watched it from his desk with a sense of morbid fascination. Tony calmly raised his pistol and splattered its brains onto the hallway wall outside of his office. The thing's lifeless form crumpled to the carpeted floor. The city was no longer a safe place to be. Tony picked up the phone and wasn't surprised to find it was out again. He rose from his seat at the desk and stepped over the thing's body into the waiting room outside his office proper. He glanced around at the stacks of outdated magazines and the still broken sign which hung on the open outer door.
Having it fixed just seemed so pointless now. Besides, he wasn't sure there was anyone left to fix it. He guessed that his career as a private investigator was over too. His new job had become just staying alive. He turned towards the waiting room's oversized window, which looked out into the city below. It looked as if the whole city were ablaze. There was no chorus of sirens or gunshots, or even screams on the street tonight. The only sound that could be heard was the sound of thousands of soulless voices moaning in hunger and pain. It sent a shiver down Tony's spine. Tony tore his eyes away from the city and stepped back into his office. With a trembling hand, he slid open the top drawer of his desk, getting out a half-empty bottle of Jack Daniels and a well-used tumbler. As he poured the glass full, he caught his own reflection on the screen of the useless TV, which was bolted into the opposite wall. He stared up at it, appraising what he had become. He hadn't shaved in 4 days, and his prematurely graying hair was a mess. His business suit looked almost as ratty as that of the soldier who lay on his carpet in a pool of blood and black pus. Tony laughed and emptied the tumbler in one huge gulp. The whiskey burned its way down his throat, almost making his eyes water with its intensity. Those damn things out there would have one hell of a time making him move, he promised himself. The office had been his father's before him, and he had no intention of fleeing the city, even now. It might be a bit safer in the rural areas, but how long would it take for the things to wander out of the city and reach even them? There was really no safe place to be alive. He started pouring the second glass as he heard them. More of the creatures were shuffling their way up the stairs towards his office's floor. He sat back down at his desk and leaned back in the chair. He held his pistol aimed at the doorway as he downed his second glass of whiskey. The lights in the office flickered and went out as the first of the things made its way inside. He placed a round in its forehead as 3 more of the creatures lumbered through the doorway in its wake. He swung his gun to the left and took aim at the closest of the new arrivals. When he pulled the trigger, the handgun clicked empty. Tony tossed the gun aside, picking up the bottle of Jack Daniels. He drained it as the things drew closer to him. "They're not making me leave," he promised himself again, as rotting hands reached out for him. He struggled as they pulled him over his desk and dropped him to the floor between them. As they sank to their knees over him, he punched, kicked, and screamed at them as their teeth ripped and shredded his flesh. As Tony's eyes slid closed, he felt the warmth of his own blood washing over him as one of the things dug into and tore open his throat with its dull fingernails. And good librarians, I'm pleading with you. And you know your good old Dr. Puss. He don't plead too much. He bleeds real good, and he causes other people to bleed real good. But he don't plead too much. I'm begging you. I need y'all to go to CreateSpace or Amazon.com and buy this book. It's an incredible book of the greatest zombie short stories that I've ever read. And I have never led you astray on great zombie stuff. It's Eric S. Brown's Unabridged, Unabashed, and Undead. Just go to Amazon, type in Eric S. Brown, and up will pop a link to Unabridged, Unabashed, and Undead. We need to sell some of these stories. We need to get the word out on how great Eric is as a writer in the zombie genre. Hell, how great he is as a writer, period. I need your help. Sales are not even close to what I had hoped for. So I'm asking. Spend that $14.95 and buy a copy of Eric's Unabridged, Unabashed, and Undead. And here's the promise I made on the Amazon.com page. If you don't like it, I'll buy it back off of you. That's my promise to you.
Is There Anybody Out There? A short story written and performed by Darryl Sloan, author of the novels Ulterior and Kion. Visit my website at www.midnightpictures.co.uk. This podcast was created in August 2006. The gentle lapping of the waves against the rocks, the hypnotic clicking of the crickets, and the occasional croak of a frog. These were the sounds of nighttime guard duty, so pleasant they could put you to sleep. But not tonight. Tonight there was a high-pitched whining noise added to the ambience. William Dalton stuck his index finger into his ear canal and wiggled it vigorously. When he took the digit out, it was dry and clean, yet the irritating noise persisted. Maybe I've got tinnitus, he thought, although what he had been doing to cause a permanent ringing in his eardrum was a mystery. Loud music through headphones could do it, but the last time he'd had that particular luxury was 14 years ago, before batteries became too valuable to waste on entertainment. The ringing was so faint it was almost inaudible. If he'd been indoors talking with the others, he wouldn't even have noticed it. But because he was out here alone at the water's edge, he detected it the moment it started, just 2 minutes ago. You're such a hypochondriac. Give your head a good shake and you'll be fine. Dalton slouched in the chair, put his feet up on a rock, and rested the shotgun across his knees. He looked at his watch and yawned. 3 a.m. Another 2 hours of this pointless guard duty ahead. He was supposed to patrol the circumference of the island, all 800 meters of it, every hour on the hour. But this time he was going to take a nap instead, or at least try. If one of the walkers made it across the water to the island tonight, Dalton would surely be the first to die. He accepted this. But he figured he could still fulfill his duty by sounding the alarm with his screams while the creature ate his face off. He also knew it was never going to happen. Walkers, despite their scrambled brains, had enough awareness to know that they couldn't walk on water. And they certainly didn't have the dexterity or buoyancy for swimming. Evans, the boss, had the crazy idea that one of them might manage to wade along the bottom of the lake and end up on the island. Never mind that this had never happened once in the whole 14 years since the community was formed. Shore patrol, as folks called it, was nothing more than a precautionary joke. Dalton sighed, wondering if this ear problem was going to prevent him sleeping. Unless, of course, the sound wasn't inside his head at all. He hadn't considered that. He cupped his hands over both ears. The sound ceased. He uncovered his ears, and the ringing noise returned. Dalton's heart quickened. This was impossible. His mind scrabbled for a rational explanation. The house. It's coming from the house, that's all. Somebody just left an electrical appliance turned on. Except that explanation didn't fit. All the doors and windows were shut, preventing any noise from escaping. And besides, Evans was very particular about wasting precious energy. Just to make sure, Dalton got to his feet and ran across the vegetable garden. Kate would be angry at him for that later, no doubt. Up the path and into the house. No sooner had he closed the door behind him than the ringing noise stopped. He opened the door again, and the tone returned. He could contain himself no longer. "Hey," he called up the stairs, "everybody get up!" 10 minutes later, the whole community was standing by the water's edge in their pajamas. 4 men, 2 women, and 3 youngsters. Everyone kept quiet, staring across the lake. The darkness of the water was broken by a line of glittering light, the moon's reflection, which led from the water's edge across Loch Ness to the dim outline of rooftops 3 kilometres away. No lights shone on those streets. What Dalton and the others were hearing was no natural sound, nothing that any animal or the wind could emit. This was man-made. Little Sarah Harris, 6 years old, rubbed the sleep from her eyes and looked around at the adults, wondering why they were so mesmerised. "What is it, Daddy?" she asked. "It's a siren, sweetheart," Charlie Harris said. "What's a siren?" "It means there's other people alive out there." "Oh," Sarah said and yawned. "Can I go back to bed now?" No one answered. They just kept looking out into the dark and listening to the tone as if hypnotized. They had spent most of 14 years believing they might be the last people alive on Earth, and suddenly someone else was saying hello. Dalton walked away from the group, heading along the shore. A few seconds later, he turned towards the water and walked out along a wooden pier. "Where are you going?" Frank Evans asked. "Isn't it obvious?" Dalton thought as he bent down to untie one of the boats. "We need to think about this," Evans said. "What's to think about?" Dalton retorted. "Someone's shouting, 'Is there anybody out there?' and we need to answer." "You don't know that," Harris said. "How do you know one of the walkers wasn't just wandering around some factory somewhere and the thing just happened to lean on a lever by accident, turning that siren on?" Dalton chuffed. "You think anything still works out there after 14 years? He pointed across the water. "Somebody set that noise up. Somebody alive." "All I'm saying is we shouldn't rush," Evans suggested. "We need to think this through, decide what's best." "We don't know how long that siren's going to last," Dalton said. "Could be 2 minutes or 2 weeks. If we don't find it before it stops, we never will." He jumped down into the boat. It was a small cruiser, about 5 meters long, with a cabin and an outboard motor. Harris's wife, Chloe, said, "But the river will only take you so far. Then you'll have to go on foot, across land." "Relax, love," Harris said. "We've all been on scavenging trips before." "Aye, by daylight. and Wilson got himself killed in one of them, if you remember. Harris started walking back towards the house. Where are you going? To get changed. You don't think I'm heading down the river in these? Harris pointed at his pajamas. What? You're going? Be back before you know it. He turned away and ran into the house. Dalton topped the fuel tank. It gave off a hollow ring, empty. How about it, Evans? Juice her up? Emergencies only, Evans replied. You know that. I think this qualifies, don't you? Dalton said. Evans hesitated, then shifted his attention to Roger McKee. Go get them a barrel. One barrel. By the time McKee returned, Harris was back, fully dressed, with a pistol stuffed down the back of his jeans. He lifted Sarah and gave her a big hug, followed by a kiss. Harris, please, Chloe begged. Don't make a scene, love. I'm going and that's that. Harris placed the child in his wife's arms, kissed Chloe goodbye, and jumped in the boat. After filling up the tank, Dalton pulled the ripcord and the engine roared into life. The mechanical purr drowned out the siren completely, but he had a general idea of the direction and that would be enough for now. Good luck, man, Evans called as the boat surged forward into the dark. They headed south across Loch Ness and reached the shoreline within half an hour. Dalton switched off the engine and listened. Definitely louder, I'd say, and still due south. The question is, Harris said, do we go on foot from here or do we detour west and use the river? Although it was dark, they knew the mouth of the River Ban was near the southwest corner of the lake, and they knew the river wound its way southeast for many kilometres. It was their usual scavenging route, a safer method of raiding towns and villages than travelling across land, and it allowed them to venture much further from home than they would otherwise have dared. Harris switched on a flashlight and shone the beam inland. About 30 metres ahead, a road ran parallel to the water's edge, overgrown with tall weeds. Beyond that, an overturned car lay in a ditch in front of dense woodland. To the left, behind an out-of-control lawn, was a quaint cottage smothered in ivy. From somewhere close by came a groan. Harris swept the flashlight to the right, catching a brief glimpse of a figure standing on the road. He brought the beam back again, coming to rest on the source of the noise. The walker had once been a man in his 20s, judging by what was left of its appearance. Its face was still intact, except for one eye and whatever damage time and maggots had done in 14 years. It was wearing a pair of tattered denim jeans and a mouldy t-shirt. Something glinted on its chest. A knife. So this guy had seen some action. In his mind's eye, Dalton imagined some poor fellow plunging the blade into this walker's heart, foolishly imagining that the strike would be enough to kill it. You chose the wrong vital organ, pal, he thought. The walker groaned again, with a hint of anger. It raised its arms and staggered towards the light. Harris's beam wavered as he reached into the back of his jeans. Dalton gripped the other man's arm. Save your ammo. We'll try the river. Might as well get as much use out of this boat as we can. He switched on the engine. The noise aggravated the walker. It reached the water's edge and staggered on, its ankles disappearing under the surface. But the boat cruised slowly west, leaving the creature's shambling form behind within a couple of minutes. They stopped the boat periodically, but by the time they had travelled 8 kilometres along the river, there was no longer any need for pause. The siren was audible above the rumble of the engine. The clouds on the eastern skyline were suffused with reds and purples from the first rays of the sun, exuding a beauty that was in stark contrast to the cursed landscape below. Occasionally, a lone walker would notice the boat and stagger through the weeds towards the edge of the river, moaning hungrily. Dalton and Harris never saw more than one creature at any given time. That was the advantage in travelling by water. There had never been much urban development along the river, few people living there in the past meant few dead people wandering there today. The next bend revealed a massive stone bridge with three arches spanning the river 200 meters ahead. In the dull morning light, the outlines of tall buildings could be seen on either side of the bridge. Some of them had signs hanging above their doors and windows. On the side of one building, the tattered remains of a 30-foot-wide billboard proclaimed, "Sky TV, only $14.99 per month." "What town is this?" Harris asked. "Portadown," Dalton answered, and switched off the engine for the last time. Harris didn't need to ask why. The river continued southeast, whereas the siren was coming from somewhere northeast of here. The change in direction had been so abrupt that the source had to be close by. "I'm guessing we've only got a couple of kilometers ahead of us," Harris said. "Let's hope so." To the left were several jetties housing three moss-infested boats, none of which were fully afloat. Beyond the jetties, behind a veil of long grass, lay the skeleton of an old boathouse, its walls having rotted away and its roof now lying on the floor. Dalton grabbed an oar and began to paddle. Within minutes, the boat was secured and the two men were standing on solid ground. "Hello," Harris called. "Anybody here?" Dalton chuffed and rolled his eyes. "What are you expecting, tea and biscuits?" "Well, if one of those things is lying down somewhere in all this grass..." "Aye, it might be taking a nap." "I'm just being careful. I don't want anything reaching out and biting me on the ankle." "Well then, what you should have said was, come on out, dinner is served!" Without waiting for a reply, Dalton stepped forward. The tall grass to the left of him rustled. Dalton felt something latch onto his boot. He lost his balance and fell forward onto his chest. Stiff, cold fingers grasped at his ankles, clawing up his legs. He twisted over onto his back, bringing the shotgun to bear, terror filling his mind to a degree he hadn't experienced in years. At the same time, Harris darted to Dalton's side and delivered a swift kick to the walker's abdomen, hard enough to dislodge its fingers and flip its body over and away from its prey. Dalton scrambled to his feet, panting. He got a proper look at his assailant for the first time. For once, the word walker didn't quite fit the bill. The creature's legs were missing. Nothing remained but two ugly stumps where cartilage and bone protruded. The lower half of its jaw was gone too, giving it a more gruesome appearance than most of its brethren. Unable to walk and unable to groan, it was unwittingly a creature of stealth. "You should be more careful," Harris said. "Point taken." Dalton brought his boot down on the walker's chest, pinning it to the ground. Its hands grasped at the man's trousers. "Look at it. Doesn't have the sense to know it can't even take a bite with a mouth like that." Harris pulled the pistol from the back of his jeans. "Shall I?" But Dalton was already unsheathing a large hunting knife from around his waist. With his boot still planted firmly on the walker's chest, he leaned forward and grasped a handful of its hair. Holding the head still, he used his other hand to bring the blade down slowly, first piercing the eye and then sliding it into the brain. The creature's fingers went limp and fell to the ground, never to rise again. Beyond the boathouse was a rickety old wooden gate wide enough for a car, with barbed wire along the top. The gate was lying open and a rusty chain hung loose. "I remember this place," Dalton said. "It was about 10 years ago. There should be a car park through there and a big store. The place where I got Kate her fancy electric heater." The car park was about 100 meters square, located in a secluded spot surrounded by tall buildings. There was nothing parked here now but weeds and litter. At the far end, above panes of broken glass, which Dalton remembered breaking, was a sign saying Portadown Fireplaces. To the right of this, a thin road provided the only exit to the area. "What's through there?" Harris asked, pointing. "Downtown, I guess." "I thought you'd been here before." "Right here, yes. I didn't go any further. Town centres are too risky. So come on." Storefronts lined both sides of the road. Gary's Bar, Poots Funeral Directors, The Frying Saucer, Ross Raymond's Cycles. Across the bridge, the rest of the town centre lay in a desolate sprawl. There was not a single walker in sight. Dalton stood in the middle of the street, stunned. This was something he had never seen before. In all his experience of scavenging, every downtown area he had encountered had always been teeming with undead life. The opportunity of raiding all these unguarded shops made him tremble with excitement. But he was here on more pressing business. And the nagging question remained, if the dead were not downtown? Where are they? Harris asked. Dalton turned away from the town centre to face the direction of the siren. He began to worry about what lay ahead. The sound led Dalton and Harris uphill along Carrickblacker Avenue, where the shops ended and the suburbs began. Again, the place was deserted. They walked on the centre of the road, since many of the footpaths were now overgrown with garden trees and hedges gone wild. Passing the spire of Edenderry Methodist Church, Harris stopped and took a penknife from his pocket. He cut a strip of material from his sleeve, then sliced it into four smaller pieces, two of which he handed to Dalton. Dalton didn't need to ask what they were intended for. He immediately pushed the material into his ears, while Harris did likewise. The siren's whine was mercifully dulled. Dalton and Harris knew they had reached Journey's End when they heard a new sound. Even above the wheel of the siren, even with their ears stuffed up, they could hear the moans and growls of the walkers all rolled into a single mass of noise. On Kilcomain Road, at the crest of the hill, the two men stood facing the open gates of an expansive set of buildings labelled Portadown College. The driveway curved around the side of the main building to a car park, after which the land appeared to fall away. Although the sun was now peering over the horizon, illuminating everything, the men had no way of seeing what was beyond the building from this angle. Dalton stepped forward. Harris grabbed his arm. "This is madness," he said, raising his voice over the noise. "That racket's coming from way over there," Dalton said, pointing in the direction of the car park. "My guess is the building's empty. If we can get onto the roof..." Harris shook his head. "This isn't what we expected. Let's just go." "Do what you like," Dalton said. "But after coming this far, I'm not about to bail out just because I'm nervous." He shrugged out of Harris's grip and strode on. After a moment's consideration, the other man followed. The entrance doors were shattered, providing easy access. Dalton stepped into the foyer, his boots crunching on pieces of glass. One glance to the left revealed an assembly hall littered with dusty old blankets and sleeping bags. Clearly, the building had been used as a rescue station back when the world started going to hell. And like all of those stations, things had gone bad quickly. Small islands were the only places of safety, the smaller the better. Dalton and Harris headed along a corridor, the noise of the walkers diminishing. They found a flight of stairs and kept on it until they were at the top, two floors up. Here, classrooms lined both sides of the corridor. Some doors were open, others closed. The walls were decorated with photographs of students in black and cyan uniforms, all of whom you could say with reasonable certainty were long dead. The air up here was stale. Dalton kept his shotgun in front of him at all times. Having his ears plugged meant he probably wouldn't hear a walker creeping up on him, even if it were moaning. After a few minutes of searching, the two men located a thin stairway leading up to a closed door with a padlock. Dalton aimed his shotgun and fired. The padlock and a sizable portion of the door disappeared. Pale sunlight streamed through the hole. Dalton stepped up and pushed the door open. He walked out onto a flat roof, the collective moans of the dead assaulting his ears again. As the men walked slowly across the gravel surface, the edge of the roof receded to the bottom of their field of vision, like a theatre curtain pulling back to reveal a scene. And what a scene! Dalton and Harris were looking at what was once a rugby field, although there was practically no grass in sight to give you that information. You could tell it was a rugby field only by the faded white goalposts reaching up into the sky. The grass was hidden behind a surging mass of walkers. There had to be at least 2,000 of them, They stood shoulder to shoulder, like fans at a rock concert. There was a distinct circular pattern to their arrangement, with all of them facing one set of goalposts. Their faces were tilted up, and some of them reached skyward with their arms, as if in passionate prayer. Dalton's eyes travelled up the goalpost. He spotted something bright and red attached to it near the top. When he squinted, the object focused into the shape of two cones back to back. Loudspeakers. Fastened below these was a black box, presumably a battery. "Do you see that?" Harris asked. "I should have known this would happen," Dalton said. There was no magic, and not much science either, in a pack of walkers surrounding a siren. Dalton had fired enough bullets in his life to know that when you shot one walker, the sound of your gun usually brought several more of them heading your way. The dumb creatures would follow anything remotely interesting. "And he should have known," Dalton continued. "Who?" "Whoever set that beacon up. This is one hell of a hello." "Well, what else could he have done? Besides, we answered, didn't we?" Dalton nodded. "Where is he now, I wonder," Harris said. "Probably ran off when the mob showed up." "What do we do?" Dalton sat down on the gravel and let his legs dangle over the edge of the building. "We wait." Tony Ellis was the only person in Firethorn who owned a helicopter. This gave him certain responsibilities that no one else had to endure, dangerous ones at that, but it was worth it. During a flight home from a raid to the mainland, he would look out of the cockpit at the bleak country below, decaying buildings, vegetation spreading everywhere as nature tried to bury the corpse of the old world. And then there were the dead, nothing but tiny specks from up here, wandering aimlessly around. They had defeated an entire world, and now they had nothing to do but walk. They wouldn't just die, oh no, that would have been too simple. It was easy to get depressed looking at all that. Easy to dwell upon life as it had been before and to remember loved ones who had perished. But nothing could compare to the joy he would feel after reaching the coastline and crossing those last 5 kilometres of sea. Then he would be flying over a patchwork quilt of fields where all kinds of crops grew and cattle grazed. On the roads, he would see men and women going about their business on bicycles and horses. In urban areas, children ran about safely outdoors, playing games. This was the island of Firethorn, located just off the east coast of a country that used to be called Ireland. This was home. This morning, however, Ellis was not on his way back to Firethorn. He was heading out. And today's mission was not a raid, it was something new. The helicopter hovered 100 metres above the rugby field. Ellis gazed down in amazement at the crowd below. In all his missions, he had never seen so many returners crammed into such a small space. His high vantage point allowed him to observe the nearby streets, deserted. Possibly every returner in the whole town, at least every returner within reasonable earshot of the siren, had showed up. Firethorn's current population was 675 souls and growing steadily. In the years to come, space was going to get tight and resources tighter. Several times the men had attempted to expand onto the Irish shoreline, but they kept being pushed back out to the island. There were just too many returners. And for every one you killed, another would wander in from elsewhere to take its place, usually more than one. Ireland, and the rest of the world, belonged to the dead. But not for very much longer. When Ellis finished up here today, he didn't think the mayor would hesitate to authorize another mission like this one, and another, until mankind got back what once belonged to him. Ellis touched the controls, giving the chopper more altitude and positioning it directly over the center of the gathering. On the panel in front of him was a newly fitted switch. It was red, surrounded by a clear plastic cover which had been fitted as a contingency against flicking the switch by accident. Underneath, a label marked Deploy had been taped on. Ellis removed the cover and positioned his finger over the switch. Taking one last look out of the cockpit, he caught sight of two returners on the roof of the nearby college. It didn't matter. The building was well within the projected blast radius. It almost looks like they're waving, Ellis thought with a smile, and flicked the switch. A rectangular package fell from the bottom of the helicopter. Kilometers away, on a tiny island populated by two men, two women, and three children, everyone stopped what they were doing and gazed south as a sound like thunder rolled across the lake. The end.
And welcome, good librarians, to another chapter of A.P. Fuchs' Undead World Trilogy, Blood of the Dead. This is Chapter 3, Off to the Promised Land. August stood over the oven, eyeing the dial. It was set at 400 degrees. Tears ran from his eyes, and in his sweaty palms, he held an old, worn black Bible, with some of the pages loose from its binding. It was the one his father gave him back when he was a kid. It had been years before August read it, but once he did, he'd made a point of taking his dad aside and thanking him for it. The pages of the old book crinkled each time he wrung it like a towel. Subconsciously, he hoped by his twisting and turning the pages, God would get a sense of his own internal twisting and turning. His family was gone. He was out here, all alone. It would only be a matter of time before the creatures came for him. Each sob-soaked syllable reminded him he was at the end of himself.
You swore you wouldn't leave me. I am with you always, even until the very end of the age, you said. Where are you? Was it all a lie? Are you a lie?
For the millionth time since he'd been out here, he thought about how the world should have ended. How a ruler would rise in Europe, would befriend and then betray Israel, would persecute Christians worldwide, would kill those who didn't fall in line with the new monetary system, would slaughter those who didn't revere him as a god, would lead a revolt against God's people at Armageddon, and would fall at the hands of Christ when the Lord returned in glory on the clouds of heaven. instead. August was stuck in a world where the dead walked the earth, where countless lives had already been lost, where his own family had been murdered. Even though the undead had killed his family first, he still took the blame upon himself. It was he, after all, who had pulled the trigger and ended their existence on this planet. Salty tears dribbled onto his lips. He licked them away.
I can't believe you'd abandon me. I can't believe you'd steal my family. Can't believe you'd let hell prevail like it has.
He picked up the Bible in his right hand, then set it down again. He repeated the motion several times, something to keep his mind distracted, even if it was just a simple up-and-down motion like this one.
Dead. They're all dead. And you don't care. I've asked, I've prayed, and you just sat there doing nothing.
Fresh tears welled in his eyes. He hadn't slept at all last night, and had trouble napping earlier in the day. He hadn't felt like eating, even though hunger floated somewhere in the back of his gut the whole day through. Fatigue beat against his eye sockets, its pulse adding to the confusion and weight that was already crushing his tired brain and resolve. He'd never talked like this to God before. The image of the man he was years ago flashed before him, the man of yesteryear, glowing with the love of the Lord, a twinkle in his eye, an enthusiasm for service. Now, he was just the shell of a man he once was, broken and beaten, with a heart turning to stone. I can't do this anymore, he thought. No one can. August set the Bible down and got on his knees.
Last chance. Either tell me where you want me or what you want me to do right now or we're done. You and me.
A sharp pang struck his heart. To walk away from God after all these years. He couldn't believe he even considered doing it.
I'm sorry. Forgive me. Just angry, hurt, and I don't even know what the word is. I'd kill myself right now if I didn't know what the consequence might be. Your word doesn't say specifically, just hints at it.
August wiped his eyes, then squeezed his nostrils. He wiped his fingers on his pants. Gazing upward, he said,
I'm listening.
The sallow ceiling stared back at him, blank and silent. He closed his eyes and waited for some kind of pressing on his heart or some strong thought that couldn't possibly be his own. Even a booming voice from heaven would be fine. It'd be ideal, actually. But there was nothing. God was silent. His head fell into his hands, and he sat kneeling in front of his oven for a long time, crying, too hurt and too much at a loss for words to even shout out a plea for help. When the tears finally ceased, he reached for the Bible on top of the oven, took it down, and opened the oven door. Opening to the front page of the Bible, his eyes settled on the message his father had written him 60 years ago. Even to this day, he remembered the way his father had gotten down on one knee and handed him the Bible he himself had used for countless years. Seeing the old handwriting made his heart long for his father. June 26th, 1948. August, this is for you. May Jesus be real to you as you read through these pages. Love, Dad. He stared at the text for a long time before closing the book, taking one last look at the cover and the words, Holy Bible, written in fading gold lettering on its front. He said,
Goodbye,
and tossed it on the oven rack. He closed the door. It wasn't long before the scent of burning paper filled the air. August wept before the oven, unable to believe what he was doing. How could God ever forgive him for doing that? If you're real, forgive me, he thought. Stop me. Heart heavy, he remained on his knees. The heavy stench of smoke hung over him and sat in his nostrils. A dance of flame sprang to life behind the small dark glass window of the oven door. August's mouth fell open as the seriousness of what he was doing hit him like a stern finger poking his heart.
No.
And August slammed his hand down on top of the oven, using the edge to help him up. His old knees creaked as he stood, and his head swooned from rising so quickly. The room tilted to the side, then righted itself again. Once steady, he sprang for the drawer nearest the oven and yanked it open, pulling out the oven mitts. Quickly, he shoved his hands into them and opened the oven door. A thick cloud of dark gray smoke billowed out. Coughing, August turned his head away. He took a deep breath, held it, and squinted his eyes before reaching in and grabbing the book and pulling it out. He faced away from the oven, and with a big puff of breath, he blew out the flame on its top and sides, then ran the book over to the sink, where he patted the bright red hot lines rimming some of the pages. He reached back to the oven, closed the door, and turned it off. Back at the sink, he stared at the still smoldering book, some of the pages partly missing, others black with soot, others black and brown altogether. Taking off the mitts, he was about to ask for forgiveness when his eyes caught sight of the header on the open page. It read, Exodus. The following morning, August loaded up the blue Ford minivan with what was left of the food. Not much, just a few cans of beans, some tequila, and a few of those just-add-water noodle soups that he'd forgotten about on the top shelf, and whatever else he could find around the cabin that might be of use. An axe, a hammer, a few pairs of jackets and boots, pillows and blankets, a half roll of toilet paper, and of course, his .22 and the bullets. This was it. It was time to return to the world. What else could it have meant when the Bible opened to Exodus? Maybe God finally did speak up after all this time. But before he could leave, there was still one matter to attend to. Rifle in hand, August stood before the front of the cabin, envisioning the bodies of his family buried beneath. He said goodbye to each one, then paused before he said a goodbye to Eleanor. He licked his lips.
I don't know what's going to happen, darling. I truly don't. Just know I'll do my best to honor you and perhaps save a few folks along the way. Ah, what am I doing? You can't hear me anyway. I'll just pass a message up to the big guy and he'll do all the talking for me. Hopefully.
August turned and went to the Ford. He opened the door, and resting his left forearm on the frame, set the rifle up for one last shot. He'd debated if he should do this or not. Every bullet counted, and he only had 10 left. But the thought of his family's cabin falling into the hands of the creatures, the idea of them breaking in and roaming the rooms and contaminating it sickened him. The front door to the place stood open, a can of propane set on the mat in the landing. It was old, partly rusted, but August thought it would still do the trick. August closed his eyes a moment and said goodbye to the old place. When he opened them, he aligned the shot and pulled the trigger.
And I got your buzz right here, good librarians. First off, I want to thank Miko, that'd be Gil, for sending in all of the cool shit.
Man, he's hooked me up with some great music, and we got some stories, especially one by Sloan that he sent me. He is now called the Music Librarian. Thank you, Miko. And now on some Library of the Living Dead stuff. Zombology 1 is out and ready at CreateSpace and Amazon.com. It's selling like crazy. You need to keep buying them. All the royalties I'll make on this will go to the costs of the other books. When I do get the royalties back for the first month, each and every one of you authors will receive your royalty check, plus your free book. Zombology 2, Return of the Reanimants, is full, and I'm putting them together right now. Zombology 3 only has 2 spots left. They need to be 4,000 words or less. Please send them in rich text format. Zombology 4, the flash one, called The Quick and the Undead, is almost filled too. Send them in now. Make sure that for each of the ones that you send in, that you title it what it's for. Send it in to LOLTDPress@yahoo.com. For Zombology 3, you title it Zombology 3. For Zombology 4, you title it Zombology 4. Zombology 5, which is going to be filled with novellas, is already filled. Zombology 6, The Undead versus the Living Dead, is filling up fast. If you've got a good one, you better send it in quick. You're allowed 6,000 words on these ones. Robert R. Best's Lakewood Memorial is finally done, and it's already been sent to me. Even Laura did an introduction for it. I'll be putting this mofo together right quick. Z Day is Here is being edited and almost done. Being edited by our good editor, Becca, and will soon be ready to be formatted and then published. Scott A. Johnson's Deadlands is being formatted by Cody Boy, and it's almost ready to go. And Sunrise, the zombie novel by Cody Boy, is being formatted at this moment. Dan's working on a shitload of covers just now. I think I'm kind of beating him up on the cover thing, giving him lots of work. That sumbitch now is this week going to Las Vegas for a so-called conference. Yeah, a conference. I bet my ass that's what he's there for. I'd be doing a conference at the 21 table. Good luck out there, Dan. Barren Earth, the new novel, that is by Eric S. Brown and Stephen A. North, is being worked on at this time. Putrefied Poetry, Rotten Rhymes for Undead Times. We're still accepting poems, and we need lots more. So send them into my email. Make sure that you title it Poetry. Letters from the Dead is finally on track due to TBE. We're still accepting letters. And see the forum for all the details. Gives you an idea what the letters need to be like. When you send those submissions in, title them Letters. In Library of Horror Press news, we still need just lots of stories for Vampology. And you're allowed to go up to 6,000 words on these mothers. We also have a new title called, what else, Horology. And it will include any damn type of horror genre story that you want to write. Sorry, but there's a 4K limit on these ones. Submissions should be sent to lohpress@yahoo.com. And make sure you title it Horology. Scott Johnson's Library of Horror book called City of Demons is going to be produced very, very soon. We're formatting it at this time. It is one freaking piece of strange-ass mother-hummer story that you just ain't gonna believe. And that's just the way I like it. Now, some other news. Horror Realm is gonna have a huge contingent of good librarians. I plan on having t-shirts made for each and every one of you that will attend Horror Realm. I need you to send the size of the t-shirt you want to lotld@yahoo.com. Title it, T-Shirt, the author panel that Beck and I are working on. It's going to be cool as hell. We've got great authors, Library of the Living Dead Press, Permuta Press, indie authors. It's just going to be great. And we're going to be selling a primo chapbook for this, and it'll be printed by CreateSpace. So it ain't gonna be no mamby-pamby type of book. It's gonna be sweet as hell. And these books will be a real deal, costing only $5. The Permuta Press contingent will also be there and have their tables right beside our Library of the Living Dead tables. We'll have a great time with the Library of the Living Dead people and the Permuta Press people. And for Horror Realm, make sure you get your hotel reservations in. The discounted rooms are going fast. Don't get left out. Go to www.theitsaliveshow.com, click on the Horror Realm banner, and book your room. Visit the forum for details. Major thanks go out to Dan Sloan for his most excellent story. You rock hard, Dan. Also, I've received a book by Bryce Beatty called Oasis, and it is one hell of a zombie story. I'll be doing a review and a little bit of pimpage for it in all of the upcoming podcasts. Also, go buy yourselves some copies of Rhiannon Frater's As the World Dies. The first one is called The First Days. The second one is called Fighting for Survival. You need to support Rhiannon in her writing abilities. Unabridged, Unabashed, and Undead by Eric S. Brown. We need to kick up the sales on this motherfucker. I'm telling you, it is the best group of zombie short stories you have ever read. And I'm very sad that the sales have not been better than they have been. Please buy a copy. Also, pick up a copy of Wayne Simmons' Drop Dead Gorgeous. It is one weird freaking book, and you're gonna like it a lot, especially if you're into tattoos. All of these are available on Amazon.com. And now, good librarians, as we always do, we're gonna go out with a song.
Never knew how much I wanted. Never knew how much I craved. Brains, but now I'm looking at you, babe. Won't you let me eat your brains? I got the fever. I've been bitten fever and I am in pain. Fever. Honey, baby, won't you let me eat your brains? Honey, hold on just a moment. You have got a gun right there. This thing could have been avoided. Now I think it's only fair since I got fever. I've been bitten, I'm the one who is in pain. Fever. Honey, baby, won't you let me eat your brains? We were warned about the fever by the man on the radio. But fever isn't such a new thing. Zombies started long ago. Romeo, he loved Juliet. Juliet, she loved him too. Shakespeare thought that he was sleeping, but you and I, we know the truth. He got the fever. He was bitten fever and he was in pain. He looked in her lovely eyes and then he ate her brain. Captain Smith and Pocahontas had a very wild affair. When he saw that she was bitten, he wouldn't let her come in there. She had the fever. She kept pounding on his cabin door all night. Fever, Johnny baby, only want to take a bite. Now you've listened to my story. Now you moved in very close. Don't you try to run from me, boy. I'm the one you love the most. And I got fever. I've been bitten fever and I am in pain. Fever, honey baby, won't you let me eat your brains? Won't you let me eat your brains? Won't you let me eat your brains? Won't you let me eat your brain? Won't you let me eat your brain?